today in our theme of wonder. You may have noticed that I did have a little video clip originally planned. I'm going to play it later. It just didn't fit with the mood of the service at that point. So wonder has always been the realm of religion. Confronted with a world, a universe of such stunning beauty, such complexity, our predecessors had to resort to religion to explain the unexplainable. And what about us? Well, we have scientific explanations for just about everything, don't we? Or to be more accurate, we have discovered scientific explanations for many things. Things like the relationship between mass and energy that allow us to understand the processes that drive the sun, once the source of worship. Things like the evolutionary processes that could give rise to human beings, starting with nothing but green pond scum in a few billion years. Even questions of how it all began. Our ancestors developed a variety of stories to explain the origin of the earth. But none of these ancient stories are anywhere near as profound, as thrilling, as majestic, as mysterious as the story that science tells us about the evolution of the universe from the moment of the Big Bang. I'm going to deliver another service later in the month where I'll talk more about scientific perspectives on reality. This morning, I just want to reinforce that the scientific explanation of what is real is more awesome, more wonderful, more wonder-filled than any story that any human being could ever make up. So in a way, science has replaced religion, or branched off from religion. For one time, they were one and the same. The effects on the whole has been astonishingly positive, and more on that later. But in this process, we've lost some of that sense of awe and wonder and reverence for the process. Let me use our understanding of the sun as an example. 4,000 years ago, the nature of the sun was beyond human comprehension. It hung in the sky. It provided the source of all life. But what was it? What it was simply beyond human grasp, the grasp of human technology at the time. Many early religions worshipped the sun as a god. It was the only way to be explained. Then we gradually came to understand that the sun was a celestial body and that the earth orbited the sun. The nature of the sun and the source of power, however, were still largely just explained as the work of God. And while no one could possibly explain the source of the sun's power, it remained mysterious, but it lost some of its special place. We got used to the idea of the sun. We took it for granted. I find it fascinating to realize that there was no explanation for the source of the sun's power until as recently as 80 years ago. In the 1930s, they worked out the processes that actually drive the sun. All recorded history up to that time, it was a mystery. It was this huge fireball, but there's no way it could burn for billions of years if it was fire. It's only 80 years ago that we crossed that threshold. Since then, the processes of driving the sun have been detailed, and we now have a pretty good understanding of the processes of stellar formation and birth and death. But does that knowledge of the sun make it more or less wonderful? I brought with me a video clip. This is from NASA, produced by their SOHO satellite. It's a series of images taken in different wavelengths of light, and it shows the sun in a way that I think you'll find wonderful.
Thank you.
there's an example of our technology allowing us to experience the wonder of something that, as wonderful as it is, we can take it for granted. It's not that really peaceful golden globe hanging in the sky. It's an amazing energy source. Well, the idea for this sermon came from a rather famous monologue by comedian Louis C.K. He talks about how quickly we lose our sense of wonder. So I want to share that video with you as well.
Do you feel that we now, in the 21st century, we take technology for granted?
Well, yeah, because now we live in an amazing, amazing world, and it's wasted on the crappiest generation of just spoiled idiots that don't care, because this is what people are like now. They got their phone, and they're like, it won't... Give it a second! It's going to space! And there was internet, high-speed internet on the airplane. That's
yes.
The newest thing that I know exists. And I'm sitting on the plane, and they go, open up your laptop, you can go on the internet. And it's fast, and I'm watching YouTube clips. I'm in an airplane. And then it breaks down. And they apologize, the internet's not working. The guy next to me goes, this is bull. Like, how quickly the world owes him something
he
knew existed only 10 seconds ago. The worst one, because people come back from flights and they tell you their story, and it's like a horror story. It's they act like their flight was like a cattle car in the 40s in Germany. That's how bad they make it sound.
Right.
They're like, it was the worst day of my life. First of all, we didn't board for 20 minutes. And then we get on the plane and they made us sit there on the runway for 40 minutes. We had to sit there. Oh, really? What happened next? Did you fly through the air incredibly like a bird? Did you partake in the miracle of human flight, you non-contributing zero? You're flying! It's amazing! Everybody on every plane should just constantly be going, oh my God!
It's a pretty famous clip, and you may have seen it, but I don't think you can see it too many times. On the internet, you can buy lots of stuff, t-shirts and other things, but everything is amazing, and nobody's happy. So I think Louis makes a pretty good case for preserving our sense of awe and wonder. I think that there's something quite profound going on when we watch the workings of the sun, like we just did, or fly to Europe in a few hours, and yet we feel no sense of awe or wonder. The sense of awe and wonder requires a sense of humility. We really don't understand how our cell phones work, let's be honest. But we don't want to think that our total incapacity to understand somehow should humble us. In a way, this lack of a sense of wonder can be a kind of false bravado protecting our egos. We explain the sun as a thermonuclear furnace, and that suffices for most of us. But the truth is, just naming the processes doesn't make it any less mysterious or any less wonderful. So I'm making a case here for cultivating a sense of humility in the face of the wonderful. And there's a shadow side to this noble idea of humility. And that may explain partly why we avoid acknowledging the wonderful. We've seen the noble idea of humility misused. The poor and the oppressed are told to accept their lot and wait for better life in heaven. We've seen women, quote, kept in their place, encouraged to assume a secondary social status. This form of humility is clearly harmful. But what I'm promoting is the cultivation of the appreciation of the amazing world that we live in. The technologies we're learning to harness are a function of the underlying wonderful nature of reality. As the minister of this congregation, I can assure you that the world is now and always will be a mysterious and wonder-filled place. Just because a scientist can name a process or calculate an outcome, it doesn't make the process or the outcome any less wonderful. In fact, it makes it more wonderful. We don't need to see a picture of the sun sent to us from a satellite in outer space to fuel our wonder. We don't even need to get into an airplane or use a cell phone. The good news for us is that our vision can be renewed. We can recover. We should recover our innate ability to be struck by the wonder of our daily existence. When you get up in the morning, are you focused on the moment? Are you feeling your body coming alive? Are you savoring that sense, that sweet smell of coffee? Or are you already worried about the state of the world, the tasks ahead of you for the day? This may just be me, but I wonder, when you walk, do you ever think about the miracle of the muscles and the joints and the nervous system that keeps you balanced on 2 feet? I mean, if you think about it, it's so amazing. If you start thinking about it, when you walk down the street, you literally might fall over. It happens so automatically. I just love watching people walk. It's quite amazing. They're amazing creatures. Stand very upright, very graceful, beautifully mobile, all without any effort at all. Watching tiny children, and older adults, and realizing that they and you are the same beings. This transition through life that we all make while preserving a sense of self is absolutely wonder-filled and enough to keep a perpetual smile on your face. The ability to look at everyday life around us and to see in it the wonder-filled, the miraculous, is a spiritual practice that we should all be cultivating. And teaching that is one of the roles of the church. In order to live a good life, I believe it's absolutely essential to appreciate all of the everyday wonders that surround us. As I work towards the close of the sermon, I'd like to take you in a slightly different direction. As noted, Louis C.K. famously said, "Everything is amazing and nobody is happy." Not only is our understanding of nature and the resulting technology amazing, but the fruits of that technology are generally amazing. I recently listened to this year's monk debate, where they debated the resolution, "Be it resolved that human beings' best days lie ahead." One of the miracles for me is our CBC. And there's so much good programming on. It's a struggle for a minister to try and figure out how I can incorporate that into a service. I wasn't even aware of the monk debates. My excuse is I've been out of the country for a while, but they've been going on for a number of years, sponsored by a famous philanthropist. And a beautiful event that brings together some of the greatest minds in the world to debate an important topic. Like this, the ultimate question here that he's asking is really, are things getting better or are things getting worse? Reassuringly, and to my relief, 71% of the attendees supported the resolution before the debate, and 73% supported it afterwards. So 3/4 of the people really do feel, at least in this group, feel like the world is getting better, and humanity has a great, wonderful future ahead of it. In that debate, Steven Pinker made the case that there were 10 indexes that were moving steadily and irreversibly in a positive direction on a global scale. Steven Pinker is a famous author, psychologist, Harvard teacher. I didn't know. He was born in Montreal, Canadian, dual citizen as well. So if you'll allow me, I was debating whether I'd play you another video, but I think I will. You'll get to see Steven Pinker, talking about these 10 indexes as he sees the evolution of the human species.
First, life itself. A century and a half ago, the human lifespan was 30 years. Today, it is 70, and it shows no signs of leveling off. Second, health. Look up smallpox and cattle plague in Wikipedia. The definitions are in the past tense. Smallpox was a disease, indicating that two of the greatest sources of misery in human existence have been eradicated forever. The same will soon be true for polio and guinea worm, and we are currently decimating hookworm, malaria, filariasis, measles, rubella, and yaws. Third, prosperity. 2 centuries ago, 85% of the world's population lived in extreme poverty. Today, that's down to 10%, and according to the UN, by 2030, it could be zero. On every continent, people are working fewer hours and can afford more food, clothes, lighting, entertainment, travel, phone calls, data, and beer. Fourth, peace. The most destructive human activity, war between powerful nations, is obsolescent. Developed countries have not fought a war for 70 years, great powers for 60 years. Civil wars continue to exist, but they are less destructive than interstate wars, and there are fewer of them. This pin is a souvenir from a trip earlier this week to Colombia, which is in the process of ending the last war in the Western Hemisphere. Globally, the annual death rate from wars has been in bumpy decline, from 300 per 100,000 during World War II to 22 in the 1950s, 9 in the 70s, 5 in the 80s, 1.5 in the 90s, and 0.2 in the aughts. Even the horrific civil war in Syria has only budged the numbers up back up to where they were in 2000. Fifth, safety. Global rates of violent crime are falling, in many places precipitously. The world's leading criminologists have calculated that within 30 years, we can cut the global rate of homicide in half. Sixth, freedom. Despite backsliding in this or that country, the global democracy index is at an all-time high. More than 60% of the world's population now lives in open societies, the highest percentage ever. Seven, knowledge. In 1820, 17% of people had a basic education. Today, 82% do, and the percentage is rapidly heading to 100. Eight, human rights. Ongoing global campaigns have targeted child labor, capital punishment, human trafficking, violence against women, female genital mutilation, and the criminalization of homosexuality. Each has made measurable inroads, and if history is a guide, these barbaric customs will go the way of human sacrifice, cannibalism, infanticide, chattel slavery, heretic burning, torture executions, public hangings, debt bondage, dueling, harems, eunuchs, freak shows, foot binding, laughing at the insane, and the designated goon in hockey. Nine, gender equity. Global data show that women are getting better educated, marrying later, earning more, and in more positions of power and influence. Finally, intelligence. In every country, IQ has been rising by 3 points a decade. So what is...
Pretty powerful case, pretty powerful argument for everything is getting better, but no one's happy. Well, there are three major caveats here that I would like to add, and they revolve around realization that our experience of the world is personal, not the result of a statistical analysis. Let's use that average annual income figure, for example. The average income, the resulting standard of living in the world is rising dramatically, but yours may not be. Our news is full of stories of reducing teacher salaries effectively, given inflation. How should this affect your overall sense of wonder at the progress that we're making as a species? Doing well as a species, but maybe individually, not so much. If you feel like a pawn in a huge system that is beyond your control, it's perfectly logical to direct your frustration at that system, even when it is working for the benefit of the majority of the people in the world. Second caveat is that technological advance brings about change and often brings about negative consequences in the process. There's no doubt that the use of fossil fuels provided the cheap energy that we needed to power the industrial and technological revolution. In the process, we polluted the planet in many ways, to the point of threatening catastrophic climate change. I'm optimistic, personally, that we'll overcome these negative impacts of the Industrial Revolution and transition to a much greener economy. But the use of fossil fuels was an important step in the progress of the species. The progress of the species. Here's the third caveat, and the one that's harder to come to grips with. The success of the human species has put us in the middle of one of the most rapid and devastating extinctions in the 3 billion history of life on planet Earth, the so-called sixth extinction. The proposition debated in the Monk debates this year was, be it resolved, that humankind's best days lie ahead. There's no doubt that the success of the human species is coming at the expense of other species here on Earth. At what point will our destruction of habitat and the species that need that habitat start to directly impact the quality of human life? For some of you, I know that you feel we've already crossed that threshold. Given the will, humanity has the capability to preserve biodiversity, although it's highly unlikely that we'll ever be able to restore the health and diversity of the natural world to pre-industrial levels. We are in a new geological epoch. We're calling it the Anthropocene, a new age when human activity becomes the dominant effect on the environment of planet Earth. Well, I hope you don't see this sermon as just another Pollyannish view through the minister's rose-colored glasses. The fact remains that for most people in the world, life is good and getting better. Hold on to that thought as we enter the month of wonder. In the final analysis, maybe it's our insatiable demand for more that is both the source for our progress and the source of our discontent. Everything is awesome, but it can and it will get better yet. May it be so. Amen.